Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's 3:06 on a very stormy Friday afternoon here in Metro Atlanta. I hope you're having better weather across the state of Georgia as you tune in to listen to our live show today. With me at the table, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His column is in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays, and you can read the blogs that he oversees at Political Insider on AJC.com. Julianne Thompson, one of the people caught up in the terrible storm. Julianne, you called me from the highway to say there was hail. You thought a tornado was imminent. You're a very brave person to be here today.
Thanks for having me.
Julianne is a Republican political strategist and very active in the Georgia Republican Party. She was also one of the people who got to speak and sing at the Donald Trump rally at the Fox Theater in Atlanta. We'll talk more about that as we continue. State Senator Nan Orrick, a Democrat from Atlanta, one of the leaders of the Democratic caucus in the Georgia legislature. We're so glad to have you back on the show, Senator.
Thank you.
And Chip Blake, a Republican political strategist, is back with us. Haven't seen you for a while, Chip, but it's
good to be back.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
We're going to talk a little bit more during this show about the big political event that took place in Atlanta this week. And, of course, that was the Trump visit to the Fox Theater and the fundraiser that he held earlier in the morning. Jim Galloway, let's start with a real strong Georgia angle on this that you all reported in Political Insider this morning. Our colleague, and if you don't mind, let me back up a step. A couple weeks back, our colleague Eric Tannenblatt, one of the biggest fundraisers for Republicans, especially presidential candidates here in Georgia, he's a regular on the show. And a couple weeks ago, we said to him, Eric, you were a Jeb Bush man. Are you going to be able to accept Trump as your nominee? Will you raise money for him? And he essentially said, well, I'll raise money for all the Republican candidates. And I guess, yes, that means I'll raise money for Trump. What's the development?
Well, you know, we Republicans and Trump, Donald Trump was at Charlie Loudermilk's mansion in Buckhead on Wednesday. This is before he was at the Fox for a fundraiser. Nathan Deal was there. You had quite a few Republican names on the sponsor list, but the name that was missing was Eric Tannenblatt. So I reached out to him and we talked yesterday, and he said, he is devoted to helping Paul Ryan maintain that Republican majority in the House. He is working with Reince Priebus to help maintain that Republican majority in the Senate. But the one guy he didn't mention helping was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And remember, one thing you left out, Bill, is that Eric is very tight with Mitt Romney. And, of course, Romney has been one of Donald Trump's fiercest critics on the Republican side.
Yeah, and, of course, he's just back from Romney's annual gathering out in Utah, where obviously there was a lot of trash talking about Donald Trump.
Right, and with that Tannenblatt's position kind of reflects that of George W. Bush. He is finally out there campaigning, after eight years of silence, but he's campaigning specifically for specific Republican senators who are in danger of getting swamped.
So let me just add one piece of information to your comments about Tannenblatt. The governor was at the fundraiser on Wednesday morning with a few other Republican leaders who were also there. And he'd been kind of quiet about Donald Trump. He happened to be here at GPB yesterday for a meeting that...
Really?
Yeah. But not here for a news event. And we respect the fact that he, you know, is here for other reasons. But I did get a couple minutes to talk to him. And I asked him about the Trump event. And he echoed, Chip Blake, I'm going to turn to you on this. He echoed what we keep hearing from Republicans out there and others. He said, you know, I'd never met him before, but I found him completely different in person than the persona he projects in his public events. And he said he was really a very charming person, and he really enjoyed talking to him. And I think that the governor... is trying to make his peace with this nominee.
I think so. I mean, the problem that Donald Trump has is he's going to need probably 65 or 70 million votes to become president of the United States. And he can't have the one-on-one time with 60 to 70 million people to have that. I've heard the same thing. When he's alone, he's far different than he is when there's a camera in front of him. But the problem is that's the picture and then the soundbite that voters are going to get between now and November. And I think that's certainly something on top of the math problem, which I know we'll get into in a little bit, that's going to be problematic for our nominee.
Julianne, you watched Donald Trump at the rally and got up and got a chance to speak, too. Under what circumstances did they offer you an opportunity to speak?
Well, they offered me an opportunity to speak as the former national co-chairman of Women for Cruz. I was very much a Cruz supporter, and before Scott Walker got out of the race, I was state co-chairman of the Scott Walker campaign for Georgia. So my purpose in speaking was to call for unity among the Republican Party. And I've said since the very beginning, since Trump has clinched the nomination, that his biggest obstacle, in my opinion, is not Hillary in November. It's uniting a fractured Republican Party.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I think it just so happens that you and Chip Lake are sitting on the same side of our table here in our studio this afternoon. And I think you represent very different approaches to the how Republicans are going to deal with Donald Trump. And before I ask you to talk about that and then bring you into the picture, Nan Orrick, let's listen. This soundbite has gotten a lot of national play, but since he said it at the Fox Theater on Wednesday, let's listen to it again and then discuss what it means.
The Republicans, honestly, folks, our leaders have to get tougher. This is too tough to do it alone. But you know what? I think I'm going to be forced to. Our leaders have to get a lot tougher. And be quiet. Just please be quiet. Don't talk. Please be quiet. Just be quiet to the leaders. Because they have to get tougher. They have to get sharper. They have to get smarter. We have to have our Republicans either stick together or let me just do it by myself. I'll do very well. I'm going to do very well. Okay? I'm going to do very well. A lot of people thought I should do that anyway. But I'll just do it very nicely by myself. I think you're going to have a very good result. I think we'll be very happy. I'll run as a Republican. Just, the endorsement thing. I've gotten tremendous endorsements. But if I don't get them, that's okay. We're going to run. We're going to win. And here's what we're going to do when we win. We're going to make our country so great again.
All right. Open conversation. Anybody want to start?
That's astounding.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you played that soundbite, Bill, because I was going to reference that soundbite. What Julianne said earlier is exactly right. His biggest problem, his biggest problem right now is going to be unifying the Republican Party. Those aren't comments from somebody who sounds like they want to spend a lot of political capital and time unifying the Republican Party. There are enough obstacles that exist today for any Republican nominee with respect to math that even if you were to run a perfect campaign, which I'm going to go out on a limb and say is not going to happen, that he could do everything right and still lose this race.
All right, let me challenge that if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And again, I open this up to anybody who wants to grab it. Trump would say, hey, I won the nomination. I got more votes than any other Republican primary candidate for president in the history of primaries. I've done pretty well doing it my day way. I don't need the Republican Party to help me.
Now, here's the thing. Political movements, political campaigns are largely about enthusiasm. It's about intensity. It's about, are you willing to sit in front of a phone and make 5 calls or make 60 calls? It's that kind
or
it's,
3 to or, the funders.
Exactly. And what you're seeing, I mean,
bundlers.
I know we'll eventually end up talking about Vince Dooley, but that's kind of to our point. A lot of the endorsements that you're getting are, I endorse Donald Trump, but, and there's always a but.
Well, let me say, as somebody that's originally coming from a different campaign and having been involved in a lot of presidential campaigns, I have never in my life felt the energy in a room in a presidential rally like I did at the Donald Trump rally. It was an intoxicating environment. I mean, those people were very excited and they were very welcoming. I mean, I was introduced as, they didn't even say former co-chair. They said the co-chairman of Women for Cruz. and I was applauded. I wasn't, you know, I was welcomed. And I mean, I think it's very, it's become a very welcoming campaign, and the energy was overwhelming. And as far as strategists are concerned, I'm not talking about Chip, but as far as strategists are concerned on the national level that are saying it's impossible for Donald Trump to win, they said it was impossible for him to win the primary. They've called it wrong since day one.
But he won a primary, but has all of the significant players at the top levels of Republican leadership highly uncomfortable, to say the least, and having to back off and distance themselves. So I think it demonstrates that that win was in a really narrow demographic base that does not reflect your party.
Well, it wasn't totality. It wasn't a win because of all the endorsements. It was a win in spite of the fact that all of the other candidates got the endorsements. So I think that that says a lot for the momentum behind him, that people were willing to come out and even cross over. A lot of crossover Democrats were willing to come out and support him in spite of the fact that so many Republican leaders didn't.
Julian is right on this point, and that is, and I was the last person that thought Donald Trump had any chance to win the nomination. That being said, Republican primary voters are far less predictable than general election voters are. And I think the problem that Donald Trump has going into the general election, if nothing else, has to do with math. I mean, Mitt Romney lost the presidential election. He got 206 electoral votes. You need 270 electoral votes. He got 59% of the white vote, and he got 93% of all the self-identified Republicans. And he won independents by 5 points. And so those are three trends that Romney had going for him, and he lost the Electoral College by 24 points. I don't see how Donald Trump can build upon that, especially with comments like the ones that Bill just played, because I'm not speaking for Eric Tandenblatt, but if you're Eric Tandenblatt and you've got a Rolodex that can raise a lot of money that Donald Trump is going to need from donors who can put the resources in that Trump is going to need in order to be successful.
Jim, let me bring you back in, because what's interesting about what Chip just said is that one of the things you need money for, you need money for TV. Hillary Clinton's on the air with a $7 million ad buy in swing states this week. Trump's right now still dark. He hasn't put anything up on the air. But here's the thing. What we're hearing this week is that Trump is not building a campaign organization across the country. He's not bringing people into the key states,
that's right,
the swing states.
That's right.
Instead, they're relying on the Republican National Committee mechanisms to do that for him. And if you're going to go to the Fox Theater and tell the Republican leaders, hey, be quiet, this is not a winning proposition.
Well, no. I'll disagree with you on an interpretation. He was telling his followers to be quiet and just to not to give the Republican leadership too much guff.
That's how I interpreted it.
The national media didn't interpret it that way. But they asked Ryan.
But here's the thing. What we're seeing Trump do is he's going into a state, safe states, to raise money, because that's where the money is. He's going into after he went to Georgia, he went to Texas, and in each of those places, he's having his rally, and he's not hitting those border states. He's not in Wisconsin. He's not in Pennsylvania. He's not in Iowa. This is in Ohio. This is where he's. You've got people like Chip and others in the RNC scratching their heads.
Yeah, well, he's not going into the swing states, is your point. He's in deep red Texas.
Because he needs money.
Julianne, okay, so every single person at this table has watched politics for a really long time. We have all seen the swings, the ups and downs of a campaign. You wouldn't argue that right now is one of the worst periods that Trump has had since announcing for president, I would guess. But we better be careful about defining an entire campaign on the basis of a few weeks, because we all know that can swing 180 degrees in a moment's notice, right?
Well, I agree with that. And I don't put a lot of faith in polls this early on. We haven't even had the national convention yet. Neither party has had their national convention. We haven't gotten into the general election debates yet, and everything could change. 2 weeks is a lifetime in politics. So what's 5 or 6 months? It's an absolute eternity. But going back to what you said about the way things are traditionally done. Well, McCain did things the traditional way with regard to how he's supposed to go into certain states and the with the help of the RNC and directing things. And Romney did the same thing. Romney's campaign burned through massive amounts of money, which is probably one of the reasons why Romney lost, is because of his campaign strategists. I mean, and we can talk about the debates, the general election debates in just a minute. But I mean, the definition, one of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And let's face it, McCain and Romney lost. And so far, Donald Trump has been very successful.
In June at this time, for the previous election cycles, John McCain's unfavorable rating was 41%. Mitt Romney's was 46%. Donald Trump's today is at 70%. And polls go up and down, and they always go up and down. But one of the things that's been very consistent about this election cycle are Donald Trump's image rating numbers.
Well,
they've
the
been
same
upside
with,
down for a big time.
Of course,
but he
Hillary
still won.
Well, he won the Republican primary.
He won that primary. Yeah. And as Dion said in today's paper, it's like you've created a monster, the Jurassic Park that you cannot stop.
So,
and David Brooks called, in his column, a noted conservative writer and thinker,
that you're
papering over a fundamental thing, which is he's temperamentally unfit.
So
he lacks the character and he lacks the integrity.
Oh well, I think
and you
that
can't,
that's...
you can't find common ground on policy if those fundamental things about your candidate are what they are with Donald Trump.
Well, I agree, but I agree with regard to that same thing applying to Hillary Clinton. So, I mean...
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up, actually, Nan Orrick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, Donald Trump's negatives are way up there, 70%, the kind of a historic negative high. But, you know, interestingly enough, Hillary Clinton's had a great few weeks in terms of her campaign. And her negatives have gone up, too. She's up at 55%. Now, there's still a gap between her and Trump. But when her negatives go up at a time in the campaign when things are all going her way, doesn't it tell you something about the persistence of a negative image and how hard it is to turn it around?
I think there have been 25 years of hammering consistently, systematically, on Hillary Clinton and her reputation, and it takes its toll.
Well,
it absolutely takes its toll. But when you talk about, temperamentally, Hillary Clinton brings a stability that Donald Trump will never have. You cannot change a person's fundamental psychology, and this papering over these distinctions and these differences, when it's going to blow up over and over. Every week, there's every week, if not three times a week, there's another blow up about what Trump said to this or that party leader or this or that segment of our population. The latest, what about his saying he would welcome the North Korean dictator over here?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you've got some polling, a lot of combined aggregated polling that shows Donald Trump in a pretty darn steep dive right now.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton is not moving, and so what I do and what Chip probably does and maybe Bill does is they look at what's changed here. We've had Donald Trump's 11-minute spiel about the federal judge. And things are about to get a little bit more nasty on that front. You had the Orlando shootings,
mm-hmm.
and everyone's kind of reaction to that. You've also had President Barack Obama's entry into this contest in a very big way. I think that's probably the biggest difference of the last 2 weeks. He has really begun stepping out, and we were talking. Yes, Hillary Clinton's negatives are pretty high, and they're probably going to stay pretty high. But that's the one thing that's actually changed in the political climate. People have a better opinion of Barack Obama now than they've had in maybe perhaps in the entire 8 years. And I think that is changing part of the political climate here.
Jim, something happened on Wednesday for Georgia voters. Something happened at the Fox Theater that might be persuasive to some Georgia voters who are on the fence. Who did he get an endorsement from on Wednesday?
Oh, he got Ralph Reed stood up for him.
Ralph Reed.
And as important as Ralph Reed is. But then we had the Archbishop come up. And that was, of course, Vince Dooley.
Archbishop
Vince Dooley.
Who started backpedaling the very next day.
Well, in fact, you are so right to bring that up. We'll see if it's really backpedaling. What radio station was he talking to?
That was WGAU 1340 in Athens.
Let's listen.
I was at the university. I didn't think it was appropriate. I tried to remain apolitical, but I do have an opportunity to express myself a little more now. I guess you could say I'm like the Paul Ryan philosophy. I endorse Donald Trump, but I do wish you could say and do things differently.
So that was Vince Dooley. I'm not sure.
It kind of reminded me of a coach describing a freshman running back who still has a problem with curfew, you know?
Or has a trouble with fumbling the football.
Nan Orrick, this is all leading up to something I wanted to ask you before we take a break. As we've said, and I think all of us would agree, Trump's had a bad few weeks. The big question, as you point out, is can he we don't see any signs that he's going to exercise the kind of discipline that you might expect so that these things can continue blowing up. So all that said, do you believe there are any circumstances, even including all that, that are turning Georgia purple and that could deliver Georgia to the Democrats in the fall?
Well, someone else here may have the last poll taken 12 hours ago, but the last poll I'm aware of, Hillary was competitive with Donald Trump in this state.
There was a PPP poll a couple of weeks after the AJC did ours. We did ours in May. That showed Trump closing the gap. But I think it's to answer your question, Bill, it's worth noting that the Hillary Clinton campaign is headed south, but it's headed to North Carolina on Wednesday.
Yeah.
But I would just add, again, quoting David Brooks, he said that the chances of the Republican Party unifying around Trump are equal to the chances of unifying around a tornado.
All right, I'd like to talk for a few, after we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I do want to talk for a few more minutes about where Georgia's headed in the fall election. But let's do this. Let's get a break in and we'll come back to Political Rewind. It is 3:28 Friday afternoon.
You count on GPB to bring you reporting that helps you better understand our world. As GPB's fiscal year comes to a close, we're counting on you. Listeners make the commercial-free, independent journalism you hear on GPB possible. While you're thinking about it, please show your love for GPB and make a contribution in any amount. Go to gpb.org and click donate before June 30th. And thanks.
At the end of a tough week in Orlando, we'll check in with people living in the city. For some, it seems that life is frozen just as it was at 2 a.m. on Saturday.
There have been cars that have been there since Saturday, and they're still there, and you wonder.
Reflecting on a week in Orlando that history will remember, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 to 7 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. At the table today, State Senator Nan Orrick, strategist, Republican strategists, Chip Lake and Julianne Thompson, and our good friend Jim Galloway. Nan Orrick, you're the Hillary Clinton person at the table.
Indeed, so, I'll be a delegate for her in Philadelphia.
Right. Yeah. But let's go back to what I wanted to talk about. Jim made a great point during the first segment of the show, and that is the Clinton campaign is heading south, but they're going to North Carolina. You're a leader, you're a delegate and a leader of the state Democratic, one of the leaders here. What efforts are you all making to encourage the Clinton campaign to spend resources and money to try to win the state, and how are you being received?
Chairman DuBose Porter will, of course, give you the footnoted response to that because he is in constant contact with the national leadership. And there's been signs for some time of Georgia. We were the most purple of the red states in the last national elections. And the polling is encouraging that we have a shot here. And there are forces coming into the state, young door-to-door folks. There are people that are spreading out across the state on behalf of Hillary and the Democratic ticket that have not been here before.
But yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah. It is not the multi-million dollar effort that's required to shift the state.
No, we've not reached. No, we're not. That we're not there, and we'll continue to make that case, Jim. And there's. I mean, I heard from some people at a recent national meeting, not a Democratic meeting, but that there's a renewed effort over in Texas, which would be, I think, a fatal mistake to concentrate forces over there of trying to turn that state blue before Georgia. But North Carolina is very appealing.
Understand, though, there are no runoffs, and so states like New Mexico, states like Utah, our Republicans are going to have to spend money in those states with Gary Johnson on the ballot because, as we talked about earlier, it's the Electoral College that ends up determining who the president of the United States is. Mm-hmm. Look, this election has been historic. It will continue to be historic. When you look at the last six presidential elections, Democrats in all six presidential elections have won 23 states for, I believe it's 242 electoral votes. Republicans have only won 13 states in all of the last six presidential elections. So if you're just looking at that, and that doesn't mean that they can't change, right? I think Georgia's included in that, but that's 102 electoral votes. We better not take things for granted here in Georgia as Republicans, because if we do, we will find ourselves in a competitive situation.
Julianne, I would think if I'm a Trump supporter, as you are, I would be thrilled. Did I see a little hesitation on your face when
no.
I said that?
No, not at all.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay. I didn't know if that was a Paul Ryan or a Mitch McConnell
no.
moment. Okay. I just
spoke at his rally.
I know you did. I think, wouldn't you kind of be thrilled to lure the Clinton people into a state like Georgia that they simply cannot win?
Well, I think... Let me go back to what the senator said about those young door-to-door organic supporters of the Democrats. Aren't those by and large Bernie supporters, those millennials? And do you really think that those millennials are all going to go with Hillary? Because polls say that they're not. I mean,
work if they go?
That's exactly right. Or will they sit at
home?
No,
I'm not talking about Bernie folk. I'm not talking about Bernie folk. I was speaking just yesterday. In fact, there was a candidate forum down in East Point, a part of my district. And I was speaking with young people from out of state and young people in state that have been hired and are working out of the Democratic Party headquarters, a new phalanx of outreach, along with organizing presence in county parties at a high new level.
All right, let's in fact turn to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, as long as you both have brought it up. Sanders last night, of course, addressed his supporters in an online speech, which the Sanders campaign says attracted a couple hundred thousand people mm-hmm. watching it online. And everybody was waiting to see whether he was going to, in fact, formally bow out of the race, endorse Hillary Clinton. He did neither, but he did come as close as I think he's going to for the time being to saying he's on the team.
The major political task that together we face in the next 5 months is to make certain that Donald Trump is defeated and defeated badly. And I personally intend to begin my role in that process in a very short period of time.
So, yeah, that's the phrase that everybody's been waiting for, I think. I don't think you're going to get a I'm defeated until you get to Philadelphia. As we were saying off air, I think he really wants his name placed in nomination from the floor.
Nan Orrick, how do you, as a Hillary Clinton supporter and a Democratic leader here, without Bernie Sanders making a very strong statement on behalf of Hillary Clinton, that may not be enough, how do you energize those young people who were Sanders supporters to now vote for Hillary Clinton? Every conversation I hear among young people who are in the Sanders camp say, we don't trust Hillary Clinton. She doesn't share our vision.
Well, I know plenty of people that had Bernie as their first choice and who now are backing Hillary. I know them on a firsthand basis. I have them in the ranks of my family. So the day has not gone by. Actually, since
feeding them dinner,
Nan. Don't tell all my secrets.
we call that a corn pone opinion.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you know, on this very show. A long time ago, I said that I thought it was good for the Democratic Party and good for the campaign to have a contested primary and to have a fulsome debate about the issues and where we come out. And I think that that has happened. And I think that I've talked to people that wouldn't give a second look at Hillary when we're Bernie. Completely and totally. But they understand, just as Bernie said, the task now is to defeat Donald Trump. And I will say that I think Bernie has a good feel for his followers and for that base. And what he was schooling them in last night was political revolution doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't just happen around one person. It's an ongoing thing. He reached back in history to the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the LGBT movement, and moving forward, and said we're going to continue this trek. And he is communicating with his base and moving them to understand why we are.
I'll tell you how you motivate Bernie Sanders followers who don't like Hillary Clinton. You put Barack Obama on the stump.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you do it. That's what that's all about.
All right. So let me, as long as we're talking about President Obama, Julianne, I'm going to give you a shot at this.
Okay.
Last night, the Wall Street Journal, I think, was the first to report, although it was picked up certainly by everybody, this very, very, I call, say, dramatic statement that came from 50 mid-level diplomats in the State Department who are calling for the president to change what they would, and I don't have the words in front of me, they believe he's not being aggressive enough in intervening in Syria. And as I heard that last night, I thought, 50 mid-level diplomats in Barack Obama's State Department. Now, there is a mechanism for doing this. This isn't as if they stepped out in an unofficial capacity and went after him. They didn't call a news conference. The State Department has established a way in which people who work there can register their opposition to certain State Department policies. So with that in mind, though, that I gotta say, this is a bad time for that to happen with Hillary Clinton and the president needing to have their foreign policy credentials polished as highly as possible.
Well, I agree. I think it speaks for itself, the fact that they believe he needs to get tougher. And I think that it's very damaging, not only to President Obama, but to Hillary Clinton as well. I mean, when we are talking about a time in history when national security has never been at the forefront of everyone's mind as it is in 2016, I think you need to have the overwhelming support of the American people and the people that have worked for you when it comes to foreign policy and national security. And he doesn't have that. And I think that that's going to have an effect on her, especially if these terrorist attacks continue. And under his current foreign policy and the weakness that is being shown by it, not only here in America, but as viewed by the rest of the world, I just don't see it going his way.
What the 51 dissenters were calling for were for more military airstrikes within Syria,
right.
in order to...
To take out Assad.
To take out Assad, or at least
well, that's their eventual goal.
Well,
you've
exactly.
got to depose Assad.
Exactly. And you know, I mean, throughout these 8 years, Obama has had this kind of tension. He has been trying to de-escalate our activity in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, and also whatever military action he's been trying to get, he's been trying to bring Congress in it. I mean, when he drew that red line, in Syria with the anticipation that Congress would back him up. They did not. And so he chose to withdraw, which I think was probably a mistake. I think what you're going to see, this is where you're probably going to start to see some separation between Obama and Hillary Clinton, who is much more of a hawk on these issues, I think.
So we're here at Politics GPB if you want to tweet us. And in fact, we're getting a number of people commenting on the observations you've all been making on the show. Khalid sent us a tweet saying, I am a Bernie Democratic Convention delegate, and I'm now working with Georgia Democrats to turn Georgia blue. There's one of your folks.
Absolutely. I'll be meeting with them tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Ted Barfield commented, Nan Orrick, and you're alluding to a column by David Brooks in the New York Times. David Brooks is hardly a conservative thought leader. I'm not sure he supported a Republican since Reagan or Bush 41. And in fact, Nan Orrick, I think it's safe to say that David Brooks is one of the Democrats' favorite Republican columnists, wouldn't you?
I mean, I run hot and cold on David Brooks. I certainly don't agree with a lot of things he puts forward. But it's a very thoughtful look at a fundamentally troubled and problematic candidate that is at the top of the GOP ticket.
Okay. Do you want to jump in on something, Julianne?
I was just going to say that I think a lot of this conversation and a lot of media coverage with regard to all the problems in the Republican Party is very one-sided. I mean, all you have to do is look and talk to some of the supporters of Bernie Sanders who will say that they'll never support Hillary Clinton. I mean, this insurgency that you are seeing in the Republican Party supporting Donald Trump is the same insurgency that you see supporting Bernie Sanders. It's people that are tired of politicians who campaign one way and govern another, and they're looking for something different. They're looking for an outsider. And I don't think that division and fracturing is something that's exclusive to the Republicans. I think the Democrats are facing those same issues. And this whole kumbaya thing about how all the Democrats are going to come together, I think, is a pipe dream.
Okay. Chip?
I agree that the divisions exist in both parties. There's no question about it. And it's less ideological than it's been in a long, long time. I think the one distinction is the Democrats walked up to that line, but they didn't cross the line. We crossed the line.
All right.
By our nominee picking. I mean,
Chip Blake, you get the last word of this segment. We're going to take a break at 3:42 on Friday afternoon and come back and talk some more. Talk a little more presidential, but we also got some interesting state news that we can talk with you about.
Thank you for choosing GPB, an 18-station radio network of Georgia Public Broadcasting. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, collaborating with universities in China, Korea, Turkey, Brazil, and South Africa. 2016 has been filled with important issues and events, from political campaigns to conflicts around the world. As GPB's fiscal year comes to a close on June 30th, remember that listener support makes the coverage you've come to depend on possible. Please show your love for GPB with your tax-deductible contribution now. Go to gpb.org and click donate to do your part. That's gpb.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Nan Orrick, Chip Blake, Julianne Thompson, Jim Galloway at the table with us today. If I can just take a minute, we've been in a sort of a mini fund drive as our fiscal year here at GPB comes to an end. It ends June 30th. And you have been so wonderful, all of you out there, supporting our work here at Georgia Public Broadcasting and our radio operation. But I want to tell you how you've been really generous in supporting Political Rewind. And it's very meaningful to those of us who work on this show. Jenny Ament, our producer, and I are very, very grateful to you. And if you do have an opportunity before the fiscal year ends to come on our website and become a member, offer us a little bit more of your hard-earned money to keep us going, we'd definitely appreciate it. So thank you for that. GPB.org, there's a donate button right there at the top of the page. What a surprise. Jim Galloway, we've been talking a lot about whether Hillary can turn Georgia purple. I don't think, even if Hillary wins Georgia, Jim Barksdale, the Democrats' chosen U.S. Senate candidate, aside from the fact that Johnny Isaacson's the most popular political leader in the state, Barksdale's been making some strange missteps.
Well, he's got, Hillary Clinton is not going to take Georgia unless you have a very competitive U.S. Senate race. And, of course, Jim Barksdale is a novice. I mean, this is his first venture into political office. You find him occasionally wandering into territory that he probably ought not to. On Monday, he was speaking with Hall County Democrats, and the topic of the Orlando massacre came up, and as well it should. And it's interesting. Gallup came out with a poll this morning on how Americans view what happened in Orlando. And 79% of Republicans defined it as a case of a cut and dried case of Islamic radical terrorism. 60% of Democrats described it as a case of domestic gun violence that's gotten out of control. That's the direction that Barksdale was coming from on Monday when he kind of invoked Martin Luther King and said we need to look into our heart of hearts, that we need to start corralling ourselves, we need to end these cycles of violence.
Yeah, if I'm correct, and I'm sure I'll get a tweet if I'm not, Barksdale has kind of hinted or suggested that this was our fault because of our gun laws.
Well, that this was a case of that needed to be addressed through gun laws. Yes,
right.
I mean, and that's the divide you're seeing among Democrats and Republicans
right now.
How do you fix this? You have Trump and you have people like John McCain saying you've got to address it at the international level, but then you have people like Barack Obama who was in Orlando with Vice President Joe Biden on Thursday, who's saying that you can't it's Obama's point was that it's not an either or case, it's an and
yes, and I want to, this is another, I'm going to throw this open, whoever grabs it first can have it. This is another example to me of the extreme polarization in which we, you know, each side grabs an issue that they believe perpetuates their point of view, mobilizes their voters, their base, and clings to it. So the president yesterday says, well, you know what? We do have a terrorism problem and we have a gun problem, but the country isn't being given really an opportunity. Julianne, I have to say, I do think Republicans have been clever in getting up and rising up and saying, Democrats, all they care about is gun control. They're not even talking about terrorism. I mean, that's pretty clever if you want to rally your base. But is this the way we want to go?
Well, let me say two things. First of all, about gun control. For those who are saying that we need much stricter gun laws, I would say, why is it that you believe all Muslims are not to blame for some rogue ISIS members, but yet you want to punish all gun owners for the acts of a few criminals who would use those guns, even if you had laws in place to ban them? Because they're criminals. They break the law. And then if you pass certain types of laws like Obama wants to pass right now, the only ones that are not going to have guns are the people that are law-abiding citizens that actually follow the law. And I don't think that all Democrats feel that way. I mean, when you look at comments this week, look at Congressman David Scott as well, who told Barack Obama to stop pussyfooting around on Islamic terror, call it by name, and deal with it.
Man,
well, let me tell you, the U.S. Senate is taking up gun safety measures on Monday because of the vast feeling across this country that we are dead wrong to put military-style weapons out here available to the general public under the aegis of the Second Amendment. And we could go back and quote the courts over and over. You can regulate the possession of weapons in this country. That is not outlawed by the Second Amendment, and there are Supreme Court rulings to that effect. Right now, after that 16-hour filibuster on the Senate floor, Paul Ryan and the Senate leadership, in particular Mitch McConnell, they are allowing a debate on Monday because the American people are demanding a debate. The American people are demanding a debate. Those weapons, we banned them for 10 years after Ronald Reagan was almost killed by an assault rifle. We banned it for 10 years, and then in the George Bush administration, the Republicans were in control.
There was no assault weapon
in that case. It was not used by that guy. But that was the first, it was the Brady Bill. I stand corrected. Thank you, Jim. But that was the one time that we've done anything that amounted to really further regulation of guns. All the rest of the time here in Georgia, we've been doing guns everywhere bills.
Chip.
And that's not what the people want.
Chip, you want to get in?
Yeah, I think if the American people had more faith in how the Democratic Party nationally how seriously they took the global war on terror. And I think, you know, I think the president's comments earlier in the week, I think he missed an opportunity. And I think David Scott called him out on it. And quite frankly, I'm surprised more Democrats didn't call him out on it. They get some really good things to say. He had an opportunity to draw a big contrast between him and our presumptive Republican nominee. And, you know, he showed frustration for the fact that doesn't matter what I call it, it's a distraction. Well, if it's a distraction, go ahead and call it what it is, radical Islamic terrorism. Then you can move beyond the distractions.
But I think we are reaching a kind of consensus. And you saw some movement on Donald Trump's part with the NRA that maybe if you're on a no-fly list, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to purchase weapons.
Sure.
I think we're coming close to something on that.
That I think that sounds great. I think it makes a lot of sense just hearing that, Jim. But the problem is when you peel back the onion, first of all, owning firearms is a constitutional right, boarding airplanes is not. And then secondly, we don't know a lot about who's on the list, how many people are on the list, what got them on the list. And I don't know. I mean, if we're going to be comfortable using that as a criteria to say you can't go purchase guns, which is a constitutional right, I think we need to know a little bit more about
and,
that
and
list.
I think there's some effort to delve into those issues and create some sort of an appeal process. I think you're going to see
that's
that.
Two process
and
on the back end.
Let's keep in mind that the terrorist who went into the Orlando club and killed 49 people,
was not,
possibly 50, had a license to carry concealed, had a license to be a security officer, was cleared by the government to do that. Yet at the same time, in 2013 and 2014, under Barack Obama's administration, he was investigated by the FBI for possible ties to terror. So tell me, please tell me, where these regulations are doing any good, because
the statistics show that they did good when we had it as federal law for 10 years to not sell these military style weapons.
He was a security guard at an organization that had a contract with Homeland Security.
And I will say to you, first of all, to say our president is soft on terrorism forgets the fact that it was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in the war room when Osama bin Laden was taken down.
Does the president have a strategy to fight the global war on terror? And if so, what is it?
He absolutely does. And I think that this effort to cast Democrats as soft on terrorism is actually unpatriotic. It's unbelievable. We used to stop at our shores and have our foreign policy back our commander-in-chief in waging war and in waging peace,
like the Democrats did against George W. Bush.
So let me
and
let
so
me,
and so to and so to take NRA owns the GOP vote.
Well, let me jump in.
Why don't
in
you
on
all
that?
Own that? That's absolutely true. You dare not cross the line with the NRA.
Of the NRA.
Yeah, exactly. Jim, and that's who's calling the shots
time
on
out,
gun
time
policy.
Time out. Back to your corners. Back to your corners, please.
Let me jump in, Jim. In fact, I really want to pick up on this argument that's going on. You know, we can all talk and argue. And that's great. I have no problem with that. But we have a strange phenomenon on the gun issue. The polls show that American voters overwhelmingly want some gun safety measures passed by Congress. I mean, and yet we go nowhere. What's going on?
Well, you've got a very determined. This is where political intensity comes in. I mean, within the Republican Party, you have a very intense contingent that is coming close to absolutism when it comes to the Second Amendment.
That's right.
And there are times when we as Americans kind of lose patience with that. And this week has been one of those. And so I think you do have. You're beginning to see some seeds of discussion, I think. And I think the best thing we can do is to very quietly continue those discussions rather than just kind of erupting into these automatic positions.
Well, but we do imagine that the vote on Monday, which takes place in the Senate, we assume is going to come up in the Senate.
Right. I
mean, that we assume that Monday will be the day.
Four votes, and likely all four of them are going to go down.
Right?
Well, you know, we're here in Georgia where our governor vetoed bad legislation that expanded where guns could be carried. And he represented and reflected the opinion of 80% of Georgians who do not want guns on campuses. This is a real phenomenon that we have massive opinion, supermajority opinion, on gun safety regulations, and yet the GOP continues to vote lockstep with the NRA.
I'm going to call a halt to that conversation because I promised at the start of the show we would at least address, and we've now got very little time to do it. But, Senator, I want to come to you because you're in the legislature. You've got one of your Senate colleagues, Republican Renee Unterman, opening the door saying, you know what? She was on our colleague Dennis O'Hare's show the other day and for the second time said, maybe it's time to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, that announcement was timed to be released on the day that the fifth Georgia Rural Hospital shuttered its doors. Another community taking a mortal blow to their economy. And Senator Unterman and I have served together, it's decades now. And I've worked on her committee, Health and Human Services. We've been on study committees across the state. We've seen what's going on in rural Georgia with the paucity of health services and with the health infrastructure just falling apart from lack of resources. And she has been troubled by that for some time. We have a study committee in the Senate this summer that's going to look at that further. There is a process going on with the Chamber of Commerce has convened a task force. I think I'm not going out on a limb predicting that we will in 2017 in the legislature make a move to follow the lead of other states that have sought an 1115
You are
waiver.
Not or you are?
I am. I said I don't think it's going out on a limb to predict.
I think that's what's going to happen if Hillary Clinton is in the White House, if Democrats take control of the Senate, I think you're going to see a lot of states that have held out decide that the fight over the Affordable Care Act is over.
Well, and as Senator Unterman has said, you know, it's time to look for more tools in our toolbox. We've got a crisis in Georgia, and we're throwing money at it with no federal match.
And you've got a bed tax that's about to expire.
The Heartland Institute has a great paper on this by Jonathan Ingram from the Foundation for Government Accountability called The Empty Promises of the Arkansas Medicaid Private Option. I like Renee. Renee is a friend. But I have to disagree with her on this. She's concerned about uncompensated care and basically wants to provide more federal dollars to cover it. The problem is that Medicaid does not address the root cause of the problems facing healthcare, which is price inflation. And price inflation is caused by the overregulation of this industry.
All right.
Oh, well, that's a fundamentally different view than I have.
Well, we're going to have a very interesting debate in the legislature over this issue.
Yes.
It's clearly coming up, and we'll talk about it more on Political Rewind. But we are completely out of time on today's show. Senator Nan Orrick, Julianne Thompson, Chip Lake, my colleague Jim Galloway, thank you for being here. Thank all of you out in our listening audience for being with us on this Friday afternoon. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street, my other show, we're going to have a great conversation with the best-selling author, Sebastian Younger. Lots of fun. Hannah Rose Adams in the control room with producer Jenny Ammon. Hannah Rose, our intern, glad to have you today. Jenny, thanks for producing the show. I'm Bill Nigut. Next week, Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock, you have an appointment for Political Rewind.